Thank you, may be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Second Court of Appeals. We have two further oral arguments this morning. Before we get started, since we have a new group in here, I will introduce the panel to you. To my right is Justice Mark Pittman. To my left is Justice Wade Birdwell, and I'm Lee Gabriel. We will get started with the first 1030 case, if the clerk will call the case.
The court will now call Cynthia Bevin, John Beagle, Manson, for Mr. Michael Manson, Office of the Appellant, Mr. Mark Enoch, the Office of the Appellant.
Mr. Minton.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Enoch.
May it please this honorable court, as an attorney, this is my third case that I've been involved with involving the Texas Citizen Participation Act. The first two I was assigned to through a homeowner's carrier, so I do not by any means profess to be an expert on the statute. But perhaps the best argument I can make is what one of my law school professors called the Little Abner Rule, that any fool can plainly see. I'm a fool, therefore I can see. I'm not versed in the technicalities of the statute, but I do understand from this court's earlier opinion that this statute is to be construed liberally to fully carry out its intent, and that is to maximize participation in government to prevent the dissolution of
preferred. Mr. Minton, are you referring to our Dallas Morning News opinion?
No, I'm referring to Vanderlinden versus Kahn, which was authored by Chief Justice Sutterith. Justice Gabriel concurred and dissented, but I don't think you dissented from that part. I believe you were in agreement with that. On the face of this case, this is a law firm divorce. There's bad feelings, allegations of wrongdoing, perhaps even some actual wrongdoing in this case, but at the bottom of all the allegations in this case, this comes down to an office manager who, at the request of one of the principals involved in the divorce, provided an affidavit in support of a request for an injunction and a deposition at the request of the plaintiff, Beatles, and then 10 months later, after discovery that would not have otherwise been available had the motion to dismiss been filed sooner, get sued herself. It's important for the court to note that with regard to the first part, the first prong of the test is whether this falls within the purview of the act. We argue that it does because if you look at all the circumstances surrounding it, as well as the admissions in the second amended answer and counterclaim, this was clearly brought against Cynthia Bevin simply because she provided an affidavit and testified in her deposition.
Have you, in your research for your briefing, because I'll be honest with you, I did not find it in my research, but have you ever found a case out there dealing with the SLAPP statute in the context that we have here where there are allegations that this case was filed merely because she gave a deposition or gave an affidavit in the context of the judicial proceeding? What's the closest case for me?
I cannot cite to you the closest case except to say that the statute itself, section 27.003A, says the requirement is
and I know it has the judicial proceeding words in the statute.
Correct.
I could not find an anti-SLAPP case where a court has looked at this in the context of that language in the statute. It's okay. I don't think that there's one out there is what I'm trying to say. Do you agree?
I agree that certainly the law is I'm not sure if the law is non-existent. Certainly there may have been something I could have missed, but
I can assure you I probably missed it too, if it is. So I'm not trying to pin you down. From my research, we'll be the first Texas court to look at this in this part of this statute.
Well, you know, everybody's got to be first at some time, I suppose, Your Honor, but I do, but what I fall back on is the plain language of the statute, is if it relates to, or in this case, is in response to. So I'm not sure that necessarily one has to resort to case law. Nobody's argued that the statute in this case is ambiguous or requires anything other than a plain language interpretation. So I'm not aware of any case along the lines that you suggest.
And I think one of the issues that I have in looking at this for what I think is the first time is, you know, it's not quite as simple as a pleading here. We're suing Jane Doe because she filed an affidavit in support of a TRO. It's a little more fuzzy than that. So I hope you help us through this.
Well, let me go through step by step my thinking when I analyze this for purposes of writing the brief. As far as suing her for what she said in the course of a judicial proceeding, that is absolutely privileged. So if one were seeking to punish her or file a suit against her in response to what she says, obviously it's going to have to be based on something other than what she said. And that's why I suggest to the court that you need to go back and you need to look at the second amended answer and the counterclaim where they specifically said she filed a false affidavit. You know, she basically told a pack of lies. And they're backpedaling from this. They after the anti-SLAPP motion was filed by Mr. Tanner, they're backpedaling and they take and file a third amended petition that takes that specific language out.
Do we have to give deference to the appellees, the way that they frame the allegations? How deep can we go to discover the true reason that they filed the suit?
I think that the court can go as deep as it wishes to under a de novo standard of review, but I think it's important, just like any inconsistent statement when cross-examining a witness, when somebody says one thing on Tuesday and says another thing on Wednesday, I think that's important for the trier of fact or reviewer of fact or whatever you want to call it under this statute with its de novo standard of review. I think that you have to look at that. That has to account for something. And along with the other circumstances in this case, including the fact that, you know, I think something like 10 days, the letter is in the record, but 10 days after she testifies in her deposition, her lawyer gets a demand that she pay $17 million to resolve the claims. I think if you look at all of that, you can see that this was specifically, this lawsuit was intended to retaliate, strike back, whatever you want to call it, against Cynthia Beving. And it's all part of a pattern that went on throughout this litigation.
Well, but Appley's going to get up and they're going to say, no, this isn't right. Lawyers do this all the time during the course of the discovery. They find out that a third party may have more involvement in the cause of action than they thought, and then we add them as a third party. It's a big stretch for us to just require a court to kick out the case on an anti-SLAPP because we've done some discovery and it turns out maybe this individual has some connection to the case we didn't know about sooner.
Well, and again, I would go back and I would point out again, this is discovery that they would not have otherwise been able to obtain had she been sued right after her deposition. But also, that may be true in most circumstances, but in most circumstances, you wouldn't have the second amended answer and counterclaim where they basically said that she, you know, basically told a pack of lies in an affidavit in support of the injunction and in her affidavit.
Did they, what cause of action did they articulate predicated upon the allegation of a false affidavit and false testimony? Did they articulate a cause of action, or was it just simply a statement that their position was that she gave false testimony, but they were not asking for any relief for it, and you're asking us to look at that solely from an evidentiary basis as opposed to a cause of action basis, that it gives some idea that the reason that she was sued was because she testified.
I don't believe, Your Honor, in all candor, I don't believe that they hooked the statements to a particular cause of action, but nonetheless, the statement is there. It's in the pleadings, and while they may have amended their pleadings and it's no longer a judicial admission, it is still an admission. And I don't think I'm not aware of any case law that parses the plaintiff's pleadings to the point of saying that it has to be connected in some way with a cause of action. If a proceeding is brought in response to, and there is evidence in the pleadings that it was brought in response to, I think that the court has to consider it. So, again, we believe that this is a situation where...
Then that raises the question of how are we to consider it, okay? My understanding is we have to perform a de novo review.
Correct.
On a preponderance of the evidence standard.
Correct.
How are we to do that?
Like any other review. I understand that normally the court's fact-finding, you know, the court has the authority or the power to unfind facts. But in this case, the statute says, and this court said, in United Food Workers versus Walmart, the court said it's a de novo review without giving any deference to any of the rulings by the trial court. Basically, it's a review of the record, soup to nuts, the same record that was before the trial court at the time that the motion was filed and the decision was made by the trial court.
Well, then, from a preponderance of the review, applying a preponderance standard, there were causes of action asserted in the second amended against her client.
Correct.
Okay. They were not tied to the allegation of a false affidavit or false deposition testimony. Okay. They were tied to her conduct as alleged. Okay. How are we to distinguish between the allegedly tortious conduct that is the basis of the allegations for the causes of action and her testifying about it, and make a determination that, in fact, by a preponderance of the evidence under a de novo review, we believe that, in fact, there's no merit to any of the causes of action, that really, in fact, what happened here is she got sued because she testified. And how I'm struggling with how we can conduct a de novo review of a factual sufficiency determination.
Your Honor, with every anti-SLAPP case I get sent to me, I struggle because the law is relatively new. But I think the crucial difference under these circumstances is the fact that you really can't hook her statements made in her affidavit or in her deposition, and you really can't hook those to a cause of action, because as far as what she says, as far as the affidavit's concerned, all of those statements, she's immune from suit on those anyway. So they really can't be included within
that.
But
she can't. But you would have to agree she can't immunize herself from allegedly tortious conduct by simply testifying about it. In other words, the testimony coming after the conduct doesn't immunize the conduct if it in fact was actionable. So how are we to square that circle in terms of making a determination that here this lawsuit against her is about the deposition and is about the affidavit and is not, as also alleged in the exact same document, about the allegedly tortious conduct to begin with?
I think that the court, and I'm not suggesting that this is in any way an easy task, and also in deference to Justice Pittman's statement earlier, there's not, I think, a bright green line in a case of this nature, but I think that you have to look not only to the plaintiff's, to Beadle's own statements in his allegations that were in existence at the time the motion was filed, but I think you have to look at the totality of the circumstances, including, because you can look at circumstantial evidence in these cases. The Supreme Court has been saying that since Lifshey 1. I think you have to look at the totality of the circumstances. You have to look at the admissions, albeit not judicial admissions, but you have to look at the admissions that were made by the plaintiff and make that determination. It either amounts to a preponderance of the evidence or it does not. It either falls within the statute or it does not. Justice Gabriel, I think you were on my panel in the Webb case. I said it before, this is a clunky statute. It's not the most efficient statute in the world. Nonetheless, it's all we've got. But I can certainly tell you that what the standard of review is not. The standard of review is not a deferential legal sufficiency, factual sufficiency review as the appellee has implied. I think that you take this case, you pick it up, you look at the whole thing all over again, just like the trial court. Is that burdensome on the court's time and resources? Perhaps. But it's what we've been given.
So we can make a credibility determination based upon the record anew?
I don't know that you can make a credibility determination, especially since so much of it deals with documents. I mean, how do you determine the credibility of a pleading? I understand that that is a concern of yours from the Webb case. I understand that it is a concern because the analysis under the statute seems to exclude any kind of a credibility determination that might ordinarily be left up to a jury. But I think what you do is simply analyze the evidence. Perhaps, I don't know if the answer would be an elevated summary judgment review. The court has said it's not that the analysis, it's not a heightened standard of review, but they did say that it has to be clear and it has to be specific. And I don't think that just putting a volume of documents up there is either clear or specific. But I'll tell you what I think is clear are the statements that they made in the second amended answer and counterclaim. Now, is that enough tied up with the other facts? I believe it is, but the decision is not mine.
Your time has expired. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. To the extent I may not have addressed any of the other points, I'll just leave those to the briefs.
May it please this honorable court. I am Mark Enoch, and I'm proud to be here today with my two sons, Matthew Enoch and Preston Enoch. And we're here for the appellee John Beatles individually and as the executor of the estate of his father, Dudley Beatles. He and his wife, Allison, are in the room and watching this. First of all, Beving relies heavily on excluded evidence and did not appeal that evidence, as we pointed out in our brief. For example, she relies on affidavit testimony and cites it in her brief that was excluded by the trial court. That was not appealed by the trial court. That is not appealable in an interlocutory appeal. Therefore, Justice Birdwell, the statute does not allow you to appeal that which the TCPA doesn't allow on an interlocutory basis. They did not appeal the exclusion of the evidence. It is not before this court. She claims to have been wrongfully added to the lawsuit. Yet she failed to tell the court that the trial court granted leave to do that. Now, if the trial court grants leave to add a party, that's an abuse of discretion issue. That was not appealed. That is not before this court. Most importantly, she relies on an excluded pleading. Rule 65 clearly says, and the Supreme Court has said over and over, that an amended pleading takes the place of and supersedes the previous pleading.
But that doesn't erase the statements in the pleading?
I believe it does, Your Honor.
Tell me why and give me some cases on that.
You're on the case side in the brief. I'll be happy to pull it up here. The issue is
The actual question is why we should impose Rule 65 into the statute. We're here interpreting the statute of what it means, pleading, to
yes.
consider pleadings.
Yes, sir.
And the Second Amendment is a pleading, is it not?
It is not, sir.
It's not.
Yeah, that's our position.
On what basis do you say that?
I'm sorry?
On what basis do you say that?
Because the law is that an amended pleading supersedes a pleading. Therefore...
Okay, that's a rule.
No, I understand.
That's a rule. What evidence do you have that the legislature intended to adopt that rule for purposes of excluding the consideration of pleadings in this case?
I understand your question.
I'm sorry.
And excuse me. The pleading can be contemplated, can be reviewed by this court, and could be the superseded pleading can be looked at by this court and could have been looked by the trial court. Had it been proved up as any judicial admission from a superseded pleading in evidence. So the issue is a pleading is a live pleading as defined by TCPA cases cited in the brief. This was not the live pleading. Then the issue is
the word live does not appear in the statute, counsel.
I think we have a case, Judge, and I don't have it. I'll be happy to ask my smarter son about this.
Well, you referred to it as an excluded pleading.
No.
It wasn't excluded by the trial court, so that was just...
That was a misstatement on my part. It was not excluded, Your Honor.
All right.
It was superseded, and Mr. Tanner could have attached as an affidavit the superseded pleading and it could have been considered by the trial court, and it could be considered by this trial court, this appellate court. He did not do that. Any more than after an appeal, someone can bring up a piece of evidence not submitted to the fact finder. He cannot do that in our view of the cases that we cited. Rule 65 says it's an excluded pleading. It's no longer a live pleading. The statute says pleadings and affidavits.
So you're saying that had, in fact, the Second Amended been solely based upon the fact that we're really ticked off the fact that she gave deposition testimony and affidavit, and we think what she did was actionable, and that's all it said, okay? And then you said, oops, and amended it, that we can't consider that the initiation of the lawsuit was all about the deposition because it's no longer a pleading because of a rule that the legislature doesn't specifically mention in the statute?
As ridiculous as that sounds, Judge, I believe the correct answer is yes, and that is because the legislature intended live pleadings, according to the court case interpretation of the rule, of the TCPA rule, live pleadings and evidence attached to affidavits. And so when you have a judicial admission...
So you can always plead your way out of and amend your way out of the anti-SLAPP statute?
No, sir. No, sir. There are cases out there that say when you non-suit, you can go back to the live pleading because the TCPA gives greater reward than the dismissal of the lawsuit. In other words, if we had non-suited a case, if we had non-suited a cause of action, absolutely you could under the case law. We did not non-suit a cause of action. We did not amend out a cause of action. We amended to delete a factual reference not associated with any allegation of wrongdoing against her.
And that you amended. You have a case in your brief that supports this position in the anti-SLAPP case.
I believe we do. In the brief, do we have a case interpreting TCPA that says it's a live pleading?
May I speak?
Well,
just yes or no.
Well, yes, but it's not. They just call it a live pleading. They say the words live pleading.
Well, I bet we would all be appreciative if you could point us to that specific case, either before you leave or in a post-submission letter.
Be happy to do that.
Okay.
So now let's get to the issue with respect to this case. As has been noted, this case is one involving tortious conduct over the last 5 months of 2015. It is called a business divorce. It was as much a business divorce as Bonnie and Clyde made withdrawals from banks. This was a business theft. It was secret, it was deliberate, it was conspired between Newman, Lawler, and the comptroller of the company, HR director, who had exclusive control over the financials and the employees of the company. For months, she agreed to keep secret everything she was doing. She affirmatively lied, as the evidence shows, to Dudley Beatles and told him, for example, if you forego your compensation, you will be paid back at the end of the year, at the same time knowing that by the end of the year, the corporation would be out of business because she was actively looking to take clients away.
This is too far away. This is attached to our appendix 14. This is a September 29th email she sends to Newman and Waller. In it, she says, let's meet tomorrow. Mr. Beatles does not know about this until December. These are employees of the corporation, B&L. Client notifications, we've got to get this done. Maybe a Skype call. Wells Fargo was the largest client of B&L. B&L was a document prep firm, not a typical law firm. The lawyers didn't keep time. No client was associated with the lawyer. They just prepared thousands of documents by automation for $3.5 million investment in a software package that these folks took. Wells was the most important client. Maybe a Skype call to tell them that we will continue our service with the same staff, et cetera. All the employees were going. All the clients were going, all the software was going, secretly. Let's tell them in detail that. And then Frank and Alice can knock out the local title and mortgage companies quickly. We need confirmation sooner rather than later so we can tell our employees with confidence that the new firm will have revenue. And this is about fiduciary duty. She laments the fact that her powers of persuasion over Dudley are waning. She can convince him, she can tell him things that are fact, but her power of persuasion is waning. She also refers to Dudley as being very unfair in contract negotiations and the lease. They recognize Dudley to be the landlord. Dudley was in charge of the lease, as we have alleged. And then below, talking about we need to make good business judgment and make sure we have secured revenue before we move forward with our plan to establish the new firm. That is evidence of the actual tort.
taking the assets and conspiring to do so. Now, our position for the Beatles.
Now, that just to clarify, that is using a BNL email address.
Yes, sir.
From Ms. Beving.
Yes.
To a BNL email address from Mr. Newman.
Yes, I think that's right. Yes, sir.
With her tagline at the bottom as being Comptroller and Human Resources.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Without any reference to the new firm.
Sir, this is...
In other words, her identifying herself in the email as Comptroller and Human Resources as for BNL and not the new firm.
Your observation is correct.
Okay.
8 days before this, the new firm, and the record supports this, 8 days before that, the new firm had been established. Months before this, she had been looking for real estate, leases. Months before this, she had joked with Mr. Newman's wife about the fact that they were going to surprise Dudley. A month before this, she had even sent an email to Mr. Newman talking about D-Day being the day on which they would surprise Dudley with their taking. So this is during that time, and during this time, and in the record, there are other emails, as I point out, to others where she identifies herself while being paid by BNL as the comptroller of NNL. Michael Moore, who's one of the insurance folks, testified in his deposition, again part of the record, during this time and before this, he assumed she was no longer working for BNL. She was working for NL as the controller, and NL was a competing law firm to BNL. So the fact that this particular one doesn't show her as that, she's already set up the new firm. She's already, I think by this time, ordered business cards, and she already has other emails out to other people with the tagline from NL. I believe within a day of this, Judge, might be 2 days, the new NNL email accounts were established by her. So it was thereafter that she started using the NL controller email accounts. They had documents for the new firm sent to Mr. Newman's home so it wouldn't be discovered. She used her personal texting, her personal email account. Before she left, she asked, and this is in the record, she asked a computer tech to erase the hard drives. She had the hard drive on the copier erased. She wanted the servers taken down so all of these emails would be destroyed and Mr. Dudley Beatles would not be able to see them afterwards. She thought that that server had been stolen or had been taken down and disassembled, which would have held all of the emails. It was a leased server. They would have been returned back to the lessor and the emails would have been deleted, except she forgot there was an archive, Barracuda archive. And when I took her deposition, for the first 2 hours, she did not know I had these emails, dozens of which are attached to our pleadings, in this case, our record. She lied for 2 hours. I never lied to Dudley. I never said he was going to retire. I never ever told other people that he was leaving. I never tried to help Mr. Newman set up a firm. I didn't know Mr. Newman was leaving. All of those demonstrably false by the affidavits that she had to face over the last 4 hours. She said, for example, we were in financial harm and Dudley had to give up his salary because we were desperately in financial need. No, as the record shows, they had more than $130,000 after what they had done in the bank account. Alice Ecker, the general manager, said we were not in financial harm whatsoever. She said we had to have their money to hire compliance officers. Diane Johnson, who was the compliance officer at the time, entered an affidavit saying, you know what? We had two compliance officers. We didn't need any new compliance officers. So Ms. Beving, during her deposition, not knowing these affidavits were there, lied about them. And the record shows that there are dozens of admissions, dozens of documents, and dozens of that show that she intentionally kept secret her and Newman's plan to raid the corporation of all of its assets, all of its software, all of its clients. By November 10th, they had successfully gotten Wells Fargo. Imagine this. Mr. Newman, chief executive officer of BNL, signs a contract while he's making money from BNL in the BNL office with Wells Fargo, taking Wells Fargo's business away from BNL and signing as president of NNL. And Ms. Beving set that up. Ms. Beving was the one that urged, let's go get Wells. So this wasn't a business divorce. A business divorce would have been, you know what, we're not getting along, partner. Let's look at the bylaws, see what we can do. In this case, the bylaws provided that a 75% vote of shareholders was necessary to remove a director or do anything important. There are only two directors. My clients had 52%. The other side had 48%. They could not, by the bylaws, do what they wanted to do, which is get rid of the Beatles. They couldn't go to receivership because they'd lose their clients and they'd lose their employees. So what they did is they set about a secret plan to steal it. And Ms. Beving, attached to our appendix, actually called the company's lawyer and asked what would happen to her, quote, if I steal employee files. It's in her. It's in the lawyer's handwritten notes, and Ms. Beving, in her email, says, well, I actually talked to the lawyer, and nothing wrong. If we take the files wrongly, we can always return them if we get sued, but no problem for us, the little guys.
Okay, counsel, you've been making a really good jury argument, mm-hmm. which begs the question on what standard we apply.
I'll answer that.
Because you heard my questions earlier. How is it possible to conduct a de novo review of a factual sufficiency?
The first step under TCPA is two steps. One is, does the act apply? Is the communication...
But that's a preponderance standard.
No, the first part is a question of law for the court. Is the act covered by the deposition, the affidavit, the email, whatever it is the communication protected? That's a matter of law for you. The second part of the first step is mixed question of fact and law. Was the act... Was she sued in response to, related to, or based upon that act? And that is mixed law of question and fact. And the court, we think, the trial court, just like in a trial bench trial, made implied conclusion of law. She did not meet her burden. Underneath that, implied findings of fact. We do not believe that you can go back and redo this. Dallas Morning News case is right on point. In the Dallas Morning News case, there was no analysis of step one at all. And only in step two, which is our burden to produce clear and specific evidence of the elements. This court held that it is the trial court's duty to weigh inferences from evidence, not this court's duty. And if it's trial court's duty to weigh inferences under the second part, it is likewise under the first part where she has the burden of establishing not only...
Preponderance isn't mentioned in the second part.
I agree.
Prima facie is mentioned.
You're right.
Based upon clear and specific evidence, and Lipsky makes it clear that prima facie is really the key aspect of the second. But we're dealing with preponderance
yes,
evaluations
sir.
In first and third elements of this cause of action. Okay.
And
again, my question is how are we to conduct a de novo review of what is essentially a factual sufficiency point?
I believe the answer is the first part of the first step, conclusion of law, was the deposition a covered act. We don't dispute that. The second part of that is a legal sufficiency standard for this court. Is there any evidence in the record from which this court could have decided that she did not meet her preponderance of the evidence, meet her burden?
But that's not what you're arguing in your brief, because you're arguing that we have to defer to the credibility determinations of the trial court. That has absolutely, I mean, that's not a legal sufficiency point. That's an evaluating the evidence point, which is factual sufficiency. So how are we to conduct a de novo review of a factual sufficiency point?
I think you cannot.
Without doing the exact same thing that Judge Wallace did here, which is evaluating credibility based upon paper.
I don't think you can do that, sir. It's our position.
Then why are you arguing that that's what we have to do?
Because on a legal sufficiency basis, you simply look at the finding and determine whether there's any evidence in the record to support it. And if there is evidence to support it, that's what trial appellate courts typically do. And if there is, then you look at the entire record to see if it's a matter of law.
Okay. We have a scintilla of evidence based upon the context of when the lawsuit was filed, that there is some evidence that it was filed in response to adverse testimony in a deposition and affidavit in support of an injunction. Okay? There's some evidence of it. So on a legal sufficiency evaluation, there's some evidence.
I don't believe
so. Then but what you really want us to do is then go, well, but look at all of this evidence we have about causes of action. All these other causes of action that were in the second amended and the third amended have absolutely nothing to do with the deposition, absolutely nothing to do with the affidavit. And Judge Wallace rightly weighed that in evaluating the credibility of the evidence. Okay. But you're saying we can't go back and do the exact same thing Judge Wallace did?
My position is not as you articulated. I just want to clarify. On a legal sufficiency standard, he decided she did not meet her burden. Therefore, she has the duty to show you that there is not any evidence that supports his decision. So the sum evidence you're looking for would be, is there some evidence in the record that supports his decision that she was sued because of something other than her affidavit?
What if we take the position that the pleading that's articulated in the statute can include a superseded pleading from an evidentiary standpoint, and the factual allegations of that pleading in context with the timing is some evidence?
It's the way I'm arguing it, Judge. Perhaps I'm not being clear. She has the burden to establish that there is not any evidence in the record from which Judge Wallace could have deliberated and decided as he did. He decided by implication she did not meet her burden. Therefore, you look to see if there's some evidence in the record to support the trial court's finding. If there is some evidence, and I think you'll agree, we have lots of evidence to support his finding that she was sued for something other than the affidavit. If you find some evidence of that, your analysis stops under the legal sufficiency standard. If you do not find some evidence to support it, then you look at the entire record to see whether, as a matter of law, he could not have decided that way.
Okay, that's sterner. So there's no evidence of a no answer here, is what, but I'm saying that there is evidence of a no, that raises, there should have been a yes with regard to that. So then the question, you flip it and you say, okay, is there conclusive evidence to the contrary? You're applying sterner under the circumstances.
Actually, I overstate. It's great weight and ponderance of the evidence, Judge. Great weight and preponderance would be the standard on that second valuation. So the first stop is, if you believe that we have produced some evidence, you must affirm.
Okay, so how are we to apply a great weight and preponderance of the evidence standard on paper?
I don't know, because the judge heard testimony from witnesses, saw video.
That's a factual sufficiency evaluation. Great weight and preponderance is factual sufficiency.
Right.
How are we to conduct de novo review on a factual sufficiency?
I don't think the statute intends for you to do a factual de novo review under the TCPA. I think it intends for you to do, like all the other cases, when you're analyzing a statute or under the BBVA case they cite, it's analyzing how broad an arbitration agreement is. You look at the document and you make, as a matter of law, a finding. This court is not equipped to determine whether witness A is more credible than witness B.
But neither is Judge Wallace, because he's not actually seeing any of the witnesses, period. He's doing it purely on the paper. So how are we to defer to his evaluation of the credibility of the paper evidence when he hasn't even actually seen any of the witnesses?
I don't think that's a true statement that he hasn't seen any of the witnesses, Judge. It's a rather unique case where we had a year of litigation before the appeal. There were hearings. Witnesses were there. As a matter of fact, part of this hearing, the first part, I played a video of Mr. Newman for 15 minutes. It's not part of the record. I can't talk about it, but there were other things that are not relevant to this appeal that this court looked at.
But the statute specifically excludes consideration of video deposition testimony.
Unless attached to an affidavit, I agree.
Well, that's okay. That presents something that's interesting as all get out, because there's no case, period, on any of that.
Judge,
your time long ago expired.
I'm sorry.
If you have any different additional questions that to ask, do you have anything?
No, ma'am.
Okay. Thank you very much, sir.
Appreciate the questions.
Given that, I'm going to ask that you add 5 additional minutes to Mr. Minton's time. Mr. Minton?
Thank you, Your Honor. I hope to return at least most of the balance of that to the court. I just simply have a few brief points to make. Number one, when you analyze the record in this case, when you look at the record in this case, I can appreciate Mr. Enoch's fervor in the defense of his client and in the prosecution of the action, but there were some statements that were made that are not exactly supported by the record. Cynthia Beving was not the one that solicited clients. Alice Ecker did. Janice Newman was the one that searched for leases, not Cynthia Beving. All I'm saying is, when Mr. Enoch makes a statement, and we all do this, we're all guilty of it, but sometimes what we read and then what we put in the brief aren't necessarily the same. So we need to look at that very carefully. Coming back to your point, Justice Birdwell, how do you conduct a de novo review?
The best that I can tell you is to look at all the evidence and simply make a determination. The statute doesn't give us any guidance other than to say to conduct a de novo review.
How does that not turn us into a fact finder?
Perhaps it
does.
On
appeal.
Perhaps it does.
And what authority does the legislature have for turning us into a fact finder?
Well, the court has, as a court, as an intermediate court of appeal, you do have some degree of fact finding ability under the Constitution, even though it's been characterized as the ability to unfind facts. If the legislature has awarded some power to the court that is contrary to the Constitution, that issue was not raised at the trial court. And it's certainly an interesting question, and I can identify with what you're saying, Your Honor, but all I've got to go by is the language of the statute. And the definition, de novo, the statute doesn't define it. So we go back to the case law, and that says that you don't give any deference to the lower court's findings. You conduct your own review. That's simply the best that I can do
That's not a problem that we can fix, is it, Mr. Mitch?
No, but we can try. I mean, we can do the best we can. But
would you address, I don't think anybody's in disagreement here that perhaps the best piece of evidence in the record as to whether for you is the statements in the first pleading. I ask a lot of questions of Appellee's counsel, the effect of the superseded pleading, whether that statement goes away. Would you address that for us, please?
Absolutely. Once the statement was superseded by another pleading, is it still a judicial admission? No. Is it still an admission? Yes. Is it still some evidence? Yes. What weight gets accorded to that evidence? That's up to the court. But, you know, there's the old saying, character is what you are when nobody's looking. You know, if you're not under the gun of an anti-SLAPP motion, I think what you say has a significant amount of evidentiary import when you're not even thinking about the consequences of what you're stating.
What's the difference between a judicial admission and an admission, and where do you get that distinction? Do you have a case?
I do not have a case off the top of my head, Your Honor, except to say that statements made in a lie pleading are considered judicial admissions and are binding on the parties. A mere admission, or what they used to call it, admission against interest, an admission, a statement by a party opponent, while it can be controverted and a finder of fact may disregard it, is still an admission and it is still substantive evidence. But one thing that I'm addressing this to Justice Pittman, but to the panel as a whole, is that this statute has only been around since 2011. And just as the case law interpreting it has developed as a corollary, I think that clever lawyers who still take cases like defamation cases or employment relations cases are finding now more and more creative ways to try to avoid the consequences of the statute. So just as we try to get it, just as we try to get it right in the development of the law, I guess there's a side of it that's working to take it outside, I guess, take that out of the spotlight. But that's my answer. It is some evidence. Is it binding? Are they a stop to deny it? No. But I think you have to consider the timing of it. The SLAPP motion gets filed, and then on, I think, May 9, 2015, they amend their pleadings and delete the statements. And, yes, that is the best direct evidence that we have. It's by no means the only evidence. There's lots of circumstantial evidence I think the court has to consider. But from our side of the case, yeah, I think that's the pearl of great price. With regard to the statements that were made about her telling or representing to Dudley Beatles that he didn't need to take a salary, those statements were made by Charles Newman, not Cynthia Beving. And that was admitted to by Dudley in his deposition. He said, Charles Newman told me that. Now, In the event there is, and I don't recall because this is a very, very large record, if there is testimony in the record that Cynthia Beving said these same things, I think the court has to consider which has more weight, what was said by a principal in this corporation or what was said by a non-officer employee. And if they both said the same thing, how is that clear and specific evidence, which, no pun intended, but I think with all the courts, the jury's still out on exactly what that means. But I think that such evidence of both people saying the same thing that's considered to be a fraudulent representation is neither clear nor specific. I'm going to return the balance of my time to the court except simply to say this is an extensive record. It's very fact-intensive. I don't necessarily envy the court's task, but I think that the court's decision in this case will be, I think that this case will be an important developmental step in the interpretation of this statute because really the statute's only been around since 2011 and it's been amended several times. In terms of case law development, it's the blink of an eye. But we ask that the court reverse Judge Wallace, send the case back down to the trial court for dismissal and an award of attorney's fees and sanctions if appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen, for your argument. Obviously, it was very beneficial as well as your briefing. If you have that case site, if you leave it with the clerk before you leave here today, or you can submit something post-submission, not any additional argument, just a cite. So whichever way you choose to proceed. Your case is submitted, and we will move on to our next argument. So thank you again. You're excused. Okay.